Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free.
Hello, Chicago!
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're exploring the music and legacy of the hip-hop artist and producer J Dilla. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. But first, we'll review some new music by Big Thief and Sarah Shook and the Disarmers.
Change like the sky, like the leaves, like a butterfly.
That is a new track called Change from the new Big Thief record, Dragon, New Warm Mountain, I Believe in You.
Yeah.
That's a mouthful. Fifth album.
That's a Fiona Apple album title.
Exactly. I mean, you're waiting for the ellipses for the rest of it on the back cover. Fifth album since 2016. You know, if you've been paying attention to the indie music media out there, this is the second coming. You know, it is like the one of the most anticipated albums of the new year, and also one of those bands that just seems to be in its moment. A quartet out of Brooklyn, led by one Adrienne Linker. She is a prolific songwriter who has also released a number of solo records in addition to the Big Thief records. As I said, five albums since 2016.
Yeah.
The first album, called Masterpiece, followed the formation of the band. All four of these band members went to the Berklee College of Music, then decided, hey, we're going to do this band together, and they've just been soaring ever since. They signed to 4AD in 2019, released two albums that year, and got a handful of Grammy nominations spinning off those releases. COVID did not stop them from let's get out there and make some more music. They recorded dozens and dozens of songs for what turns out to be a new double album. 20 songs recorded at four different studios across the United States. Let's play a track from the new record. It is called Red Moon from Big Thief on Sound Opinions.
That was Red Moon by Big Thief. Dragon, New Warm Mountain, I Believe in You. Greg, the title is too long, and so is the album.
Yeah.
It's more than 81 minutes long. Why did Jim chuckle evilly when you said all the band members went to the Berklee School of Music? You know, there's a bit of Steely Dan-ness, audio perfection, musicological everything in the kitchen sink. Look how talented we are. You know, there's the use of a Jaws harp on Spud Infinity. Nobody except Snoopy in the old cartoon should ever play the Jaws harp, okay? And Spud Infinity, I will say, a song about potatoes that actually has one of the most awful rhymes with the knish that I've ever heard.
When I say hard, I mean finish the last one. There is a potato.
You know, I was talking to a buddy of mine who had been a huge fan, and he was saying, you know, No Reason was another single. What's with the flute? Now, mind you, I like flute,
right?
But I don't know if it works. Long flute throughout the song and a long coda at the end. The problem is 20 tracks, and about half of them are really good. Big Thief is at its best when it is doing this backwoods, back porch, Appalachian kind of folk country music on Mars, right? Because there's always twists. There are these very self-conscious art rock twists. But sometimes we have all twist and no soul, like Spud Infinity, like No Reason, like fully half of this album. Part of the problem is that producer-drummer James Krivichnia worked on this record. You know, they were clearly in the midst of pandemic doldrum. Let's just keep recording. She's a prolific songwriter, Adrian. As you said, perhaps too prolific for her own good. And nobody was there to step forward and say, these are kind of half-baked, these ideas. Half of the record. Only half. You know, part of it is pretty darn rewarding.
Yeah, I want to pump the brakes a little bit on the masterpiece hype that is coming its way. I appreciate the fact people are so enthusiastic about a rock band in 2022, you know. That's a rare enough thing. I was surprised you mentioned a Steely Dan comparison, because to me it was the exact opposite of what Steely Dan is. I mean, I understand the eclecticism, but at the same time, the approach is very much band in a room playing and kind of got a shaggy, intimate, sprawling vibe. It's not very precise. Meticulous does not come to mind when I think of what they're doing here.
Yeah, I retract my Steely Dan comment. I think a better comparison would be Fiery Furnaces, when they threw everything and the kitchen sink in a song.
There's some of that, and people are praising the fact that it's all over the map. They're doing all the different styles, because usually the previous albums are pretty self-contained. It's kind of like a tone, a mood that they're setting. Here, they're, you know, people have been making comparisons to other sprawling double albums through rock history, and that's all well and good, but I agree with you. I mean, it's very difficult to make, you know, to put together 20 songs that are great. What I do like about this band on this record, in contrast to their previous ones, I thought their previous ones were a little bit self-serious, a little bit too earnest. Adrienne is one of those songwriters that sort of feels like she's having an out-of-body experience. You know, she's sort of a mystic, and she's writing these elliptical lyrics, and there's, you know, it's so profound. You know, this record, there's just some goofiness and playfulness to it.
Yeah,
which, you know, we need a little bit of that.
Spud Infinity.
Well, and you know, in the middle of Red Moon, you know, snippet of which we just played, you know, that line about, that's my grandma. I kind of like that sort of, you know, off the cuffness. And you're right. I gravitated more toward the looser hootenanny style countryish songs versus the more earnest experiments on the record. So for me, it's a mixed bag. I do like the fact that they're showing a sense of playfulness that I haven't heard from them before. So, you know, a good if not great record.
Well, I'm making no mistakes like the last time. I'm just keeping you around as best time. Swear I won't take you for granted, but I don't deserve the man. Baby, please give me one last try.
That is a little bit of the song No Mistakes from the new album by Sarah Shook and the Disarmers, Night Roamer. Greg, Sarah was a guest along with her band on Sound Opinions episode 695 back in 2019 after she'd released the album Years, which knocked both of us on our bums. Sarah Shook has had a fascinating upbringing. Born in Rochester, New York, up in your old neck of the woods, in a deeply religious household, homeschooled, she could only listen to classical or Christian praise music as she was growing up. There's a reason why she called the subsequent band Sarah Shook and the Devil, and is singing about the devil on her shoulder on this new album. She had a couple of bands early on, began recording in the mid-2000s, and really put together the band that has made her name in 2015, Sarah Shook and the Disarmers. They're still on board behind her now. They released their first album in 2015, signed to Bloodshot Records in Chicago, the well-respected indie that's had some trouble over the last couple of years. They were looking for a new album. There was that pandemic thing delaying everything. But now we finally have Night Roamer, produced by a real pro, Grammy winner Pete Anderson, who's worked with the likes of Dwight Yoakam and Katie Lang. So what is Sarah giving us? Let's play a track and we'll come back and give our reviews. This is I Got This by Sarah Shook and the Disarmers.
I got this. I got this. I got this.
I got this from Sarah Shook and the Disarmers, the new record Night Roamer. Yes, Jim, we loved Years. In fact, it was my album of the year in 2018. I thought those songs were, I think as a songwriter, she is at another level. And this record continues that streak. You know, she's talking about, in the context of relationships, you know, health issues, recovery, addiction. The songs range from being empathetic to full of heartache to that to just wickedly funny. I think that Kiss Off song, Please Be a Stranger, just cracks me up every
yes,
time.
Yeah. I've been visited enough. Yeah. You can be a stranger now. Yeah.
And, you know, she's kind of widening the parameter. She talked about, you know, one of the reasons she wanted to work with Pete Anderson, which, by the way, is, you know, brings it full circle in a way, because as Dwight Yoakam's longtime guitar player and foil, there was a song early in her career called Dwight Yoakam. So
yeah.
She inevitably would be working with somebody associated with her musical hero. Has sort of expanded, you know, helped her expand her parameters a little bit. The song we just played, I think there's nothing quite like it in her catalog, I Got This. I mean, that's like a pop punk song.
Yeah.
You know, if it's Poison, it sort of starts out with this sort of doo-woppy ballad feel and then really gets into this nasty, distorted section. Believer, the tribal drumming, you know, and the way her voice feels delicate, floating over the top. So she's really, you know, she's stretching out without losing sight of who she actually is, which is a great songwriter. People are going to put her in the Americana, you know, folk rock bag, whatever. But I do think that the songs stand on their own. You know, the concision, the precision of the use of the language and the way the arrangements work. 10 songs, there's really not a wasted note on it. I think her steel guitarist, Adam Kurtz, he's like the secret weapon, right? He's the guy who's all over these songs, but not in a cliche country way, you know?
No,
he's adding
Sarah
atmosphere.
Sarah gives a lot of credit to the Disarmers, right? You know, she'll write the song, they bring it to life, she has said. And she is referencing that hardcore religious upbringing. You know, she said in the press release with the album, you know, it seemed fitting to use empty religious imagery to describe the helplessness of addiction and the void of depression. You know, she sings with such honesty about depression, about relationships falling apart, about trauma, about addiction, that you can't help but empathize. But it's funny. It is not self-pitying. She is a punk rocker.
Yeah.
You know, she's got a vintage outlook, country outlook on life, a snarl in the face of adversity, anger to her. I just love the attitude on this album, and I love her voice. You know, the way she brings these emotions to life. She is truly an extraordinary artist, and this might be my favorite of her albums so far. As great as Years was, Night Roamer, because there's also that drawing of the lines between. There's a lot of times where songs, you know, recall 50s country or 50s old school rock and roll, and then suddenly the punk energy takes over.
Yeah, she's definitely not precious about style. Everything works for her, and she makes it work in the context of good songs. It's not just about an experiment. It's like, here's a song with a melody that you can sing afterward. So we love the Sarah Shook and the Disarmers record. We're a little more mixed on Big Thief. We want to know what you think about those two albums. Let us know on our Facebook group or in our Patreon community, or leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, so we can play it on the show. When we return, Jay Dilla. That's coming up on Sound Opinions.
And we are back. It has been 16 years since the hip-hop scene lost Jay Dilla. A producer, an artist, he brought people from different genres of music together in a basement in Detroit to hear a rhythm like no other.
You know, he worked with a who's who of hip-hop, Questlove, Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest, D'Angelo, along with many others.
Over time, Greg, he really developed his own unique rhythm. Hip-hop heads call it Dilla time.
We recently had a conversation with a friend of the show and a fellow music journalist, Dan Charnas, about his new book, Dilla Time, The Life and Afterlife of J. Dilla. Let's get into it.
This book, Dan, what an accomplishment. The life and afterlife of the hip-hop producer who reinvented rhythm. People are going to say, huh? Who? Many people, right, except for real true hip-hop heads, and even many of them were born yesterday, think it all started yesterday. A fascinating biography, a fascinating history of the development of electronic instrumentation, drum machines, of the great city of Detroit, and how that shaped this guy, of a unique period in time, the Soulquarian period, where you have Common from Chicago, and D'Angelo, and The Roots, and Erykah Badu all collaborating. At the center of it all is this guy, Dilla. What made you think that it was going to be worth spending 4 years on this, Dan?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, thank you for having me back. It's
a joy.
Lovely to see you, gents. So, yeah, you have this hip-hop producer named J. Dilla, who died very young at the age of 32 in 2006 of a rare blood disease. In his lifetime, he never had a pop hit, not like the many famous producers we know. And yet, after his death, there has been this, not only an outpouring of emotion and almost worship, but a real admiration for him and a copying of his styles by in jazz and R&B and hip hop. So the book is really about why. What is the big deal about J. Dilla? And I tried to get it down to something that was very simple, that both fans of Dilla and people who don't know about music at all could understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's Straight Time, 1, 2, 3, 4, Hey Ho, Let's Go. There's Swing Time, all of jazz. And then there's Dilla Time.
That's right.
What is Dilla Time?
Dilla Time is, I love the demonstration. Straight Time, essentially, think about it as every beat is counted evenly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Swing Time is uneven beats. Think of it as a sort of a ghost of African polyrhythm that arose because of, you know, African Americans here on this continent, a very American way of relating to time. It's called a time feel. And for 100 years, we had either straight or swung or something in between the two. What Dilla did in the late 1990s on a drum machine in a basement in Detroit was to collide those time feels as an aesthetic, as a body of work, putting them in conflict with each other, to have essentially multiple pulses of even and uneven, adjusted on very microscopic levels, so that the result is a very woozy, drunken, sloppy, lurching, limping. That is Dilla Time.
You know, his role as a producer, it was almost like very few people knew him, but the people who did know him were incredibly influential in their own way. I first found out about him through Questlove when he was, you know, the Roots were evolving into the great that they are. And Common, who was still a relatively unknown Chicago artist, the international stature was not there yet, but they both raved about this guy. And this was at the very early part of the relationship with J. Dilla. They were just going, what this guy is doing? And I'm going, J. Dilla? You know, I never heard of this guy. And then I went to the Slum Village Records. Oh, he's on these records. He's producing these records. Things you do. Loving my music. So it was kind of like you either knew him and revered him or you didn't know him at all. I mean, what a huge disconnect there. What a huge span. There was no in between.
Absolutely. You know, Questlove says J. Dilla is not only the producer's producer, he's the musician's musician's musician. You know, because of his connection, he was sort of mentored by Q-Tip of A Tribe Called Quest. And what I tried to do also in this book is show how influential and groundbreaking Q-Tip was. Q-Tip brought him into the fold, introduced him to everybody, the Busta Rhymes, the De La Soul. And then, you know, there's this moment where Amir Questlove from The Roots, this is before he was a television host and a documentarian. And I mean, he's just, you know, he hears JD's beats, you know, for the first time, essentially. and realizes that they feel more free than anything he's playing on his drum set. And yet he's doing it on a machine. And that began this sort of fascination by a traditional musician for what JD did. And D'Angelo would soon follow. Obviously, Questlove and D'Angelo worked together on Voodoo pretty tightly. Actually had a chance to talk to D'Angelo for this book, and he said by the end of Voodoo, he said, I felt really angry for J Dilla. He's the rhythmic pocket in everyone's back pocket, and yet he wasn't really getting much shine.
I love the quote you have from Questlove, who initially was a little turned off by Dilla's rhythms and then said, wait a minute, no, it's not him, it's me. And he takes to his drum set and practices to learn how to play with that feel.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he is not the only musician in hip-hop who had to do that.
I think he's the first. You know, I think he and D'Angelo and Kareem Riggins from jazz, you know, because Kareem was a Detroiter and knew Common and played with Common, that they were the first musicians to really adopt this time feel. But I will say this. Robert Glasper, he was, I think, a freshman or a sophomore at the New School in New York. He was tagging along with his friend Bilal, who was just signed to Interscope, to go to Detroit to work with JD. What you would do as an artist, and I did this myself when I was in the music business, you fly to Detroit, you drive out to Conant Gardens, that neighborhood on 7 Mile, you go down to the basement, and you're there to get that beat from JD. And Glasper goes down to the basement and has this sort of epiphany. He's a jazz student, but he's getting educated by this hip-hop producer on Herbie Hancock, taking him through different Herbie Hancock records. And it's something that stayed with Glasper. He never forgot that. And Glasper has been, since then, one of the leading proponents of Dilla, that time feel, but not just the time feel, but other impacts on sound and harmony and melody and timbre. All those implications of JD, Glasper sort of carried forward. So that's kind of the core group.
You know, to me, it's interesting that he's a Midwestern guy, Detroit, right? You distill that whole environment that he grew up in very well. He's a teenager growing up in Detroit in the 80s, right?
Yes.
And it's techno. It's Juan Atkins, it's Derek May, it's Kevin Saunderson, and it's like a revolution for dance music, club music. Same thing was happening in Chicago. House music was happening. It was big. In Detroit and Chicago, hip-hop was like the redheaded stepchild. They were... You just didn't pay attention to hip-hop.
Yeah, no, well, we're not Left Coast. Yeah. We're not Right Coast. We're not cool in the Midwest.
There, Common, it was not cool. It was not cool. And here this kid, he comes of age in the 90s and really was one of the first major voices out of that Detroit scene, right? Because the techno thing was still, Richie Hawtin, guys like that were carrying it forward in Detroit. It was still very much a viable art form. Why did he focus on the hip-hop area?
That's a super good question. And I think it's one essentially that you could ask of Common as well. Their stories are very parallel, you know, and the cities are in many ways very close. There's this wonderful story of Common going to Conant Gardens, that neighborhood in Detroit, and becoming friendly with all of Dilla's friends and feeling like, you know, these cats here in Conant Gardens are not so different than the people I grew up with in Avalon Park on the south side of Chicago, right? And I think, you know, it really was a matter of taste. There is a moment in the book where I talk about the main difference between a dance groove and a hip hop groove being essentially, you know, are you into this sort of four on the floor, you know, kick drum on every quarter note, or are you into the tension and release of the one, right? Comes to hip hop from funk. And I think there was a certain gravitation, for whatever reason, to that kind of tension and release that hip-hop gave.
You know, Common, Greg and I have covered, you know, from the start of his career.
Yeah.
Common has this incredible charisma. He walks into a room and he lights it up. You know, I've talked to people not even in the music business who were just, wow, that guy, right? Dilla didn't. He was sort of a prickly character, as you, I think prickly is the word you use once or twice. Who was this guy as a person, as a human being, as a dad, father of two?
Oh my goodness, such a great question. And I think it really starts with the fact that he was a stutterer. Speaking is not something that felt safe to him. So he became a listener. But I think he was a fantastic listener. That's what he did. He just listened. He was always processing input. For anybody who is, you know, related to or knows about stuttering, right? Fluency comes often with confidence. When he was in relaxed moments, he was loquacious. He was an incredible lyricist and rapper, had no problem expressing himself. So that's one thing about understanding who James was. He was a listener. The second thing is that he was very much that quote-unquote artistic personality where he could zone everything else out and everyone else out, and the only thing mattered was what he wanted to do. And that's not to say that he didn't have a deep abiding love in his heart, but his social skills on that note were not great. So his friends had to deal with sort of flashes of temper. And really, I think there's a sentence in the book where I say something like, James was very set on what he wanted to do, and either you were either coming along for the ride or you weren't. And I do believe that's faithful to the experience of his friends and many people in his family.
And operating on his time. Sometimes Common would fly into Detroit to meet him at noon on Wednesday, and he'd show up at 8 o'clock Friday.
That's right. That's you right.
Know? You're another on Dilla meaning time. Of Dilla time.
Yeah.
Buy me. Working on it. Working on it. Working on it.
Work it out. Work it out. Work it out.
You know, the stuttering, it's so fascinating. I mean, I read the book. I love the book. As a drummer, I especially related to how well you explain the intricacies of swing and time. But it just struck me, you know, stuttering, that's what his bass drums do. They punctuate. They dance around the beat. They are not on 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, or 1N. They're all over the place.
Yeah.
And that's why Questlove had to sit down and learn a new way to play. It's as if the two hands, the 2 feet that a drummer uses are all doing different things on those machines.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, later on in the book, there are people who ask James. Actually, I tell a story of young RJ, an artist and now a member of Slum Village in Detroit. He asked James about his sort of limping time feel. Why do you do that? Why do you play the snare before you're actually supposed to play it? Hmm. And his answer is very simple and very evocative. He says, it's how I bob my head. As his brother John said, who's 10 years younger than him, he said almost the same thing. He said, it's how we move. And he did this little thing with his arm where he kind of moved his arm. He says, it's a physics of movement. Mm-hmm. I thought that was so brilliant.
So it's a bodily response, almost involuntary in some ways, the way you're responding to a group or not.
One of my most shocking discoveries in researching this book was I was trying to find out when the study of these things, microrhythm, these minute little shifts in rhythm, when did it start? And it took me to this doctoral dissertation. Somebody in music and cognition in Berkeley named V.J. Iyer, the great pianist, the jazz pianist now, MacArthur genius. He's the person who pioneered those terms, microrhythm and microrhythmic. And he said almost the same thing in his doctoral dissertation. This was in 98, not even before even really knowing what J. Dilla's music was. He talked about the body being so important for understanding music, and that musical time is not governed by some celestial clock. It's about the way that our hands and our legs move. And it's very difficult for a drummer to say, okay, I'm going to, you know, swing my hi-hat, but I'm going to keep my kick drum straight, and yet I'm going to rush my snare by 83 milliseconds.
Yeah.
A machine.
Yeah, you don't think mathematically.
No.
Right? It's very much feel.
Coming up, more with Dan Charnas on the unforgettable contributions of J. Dilla to hip-hop and music in general. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
We're back. We've been talking with fellow music journalist and radio personality Dan Charnas about J. Dilla and what the hip-hop scene was before and after his death. Let's jump back into the conversation.
Well, there's a series of diagrams you have to illustrate different rhythms. And then, you know, midway through the book, when Dilla really is fully in his own, we have this diagram of what the hi-hat's doing, what the kick drum's doing, what the snare, and none of them are lining up whatsoever. Right. It's truly amazing. One wonders, you know, if we could bring Gene Krupa back from the dead and get him really stoned, could he have even done that?
Well, listen, I just love the fact that we're talking about James Yancey, J. Dilla, in the same breath.
Oh, absolutely. You make that case. I mean, you make that case in, what is it, Dan, 800 pages?
Oh, no. Them.
No, nearly 500. No, but it is because there are so many wonderful diversions. The history of that Soul Aquarius movement, the history of Detroit, the history of the electronic instrumentation, and the birth of hip-hop. I mean, it's a story you started in your business book, you know, The Big Payback. It continues here, you know, because Dilla, you know, did not have an easy time. He gets signed. He's going to make a solo album. Doesn't happen. He's never going to be a star in the spotlight. Why?
You know, right around the time that he was working with Common, he created this song called The Light, another sort of brilliant digital electronic composition based on a number of different samples from different records, but it actually was Common's first R&B hit. First time Common got a video in rotation, heavy rotation in MTV and BET, even made a little noise on the pop chart. And so Common's first gold record.
You know I ain't the type to walk around with matching shirts. A relationship is effort. I will match your work. I want to be the one to make you happiest and hurt you the most. They say the end is near. It's important that we're close.
Wendy Goldstein, who is his A&R person at MCA, smart, really smart. And also encouraged by Common's manager, Derek Dudley. Like, yo, this guy, JD, he's got something. Let's lock him down. And so Wendy Goldstein makes him an incredible offer. And here's the offer she makes him. You can record for MCA as your own artist. And because he is a lyricist, an MC, and a producer. So as part of Slum Village, he did that. You're going to get your own album as J. Dilla. We're going to give you your own imprint at MCA, and you can sign any artist you want. And then we're going to do a set deal for you to produce MCA artists like Common, The Roots, Mos Def. And a big chunk of this advance that he gets is to build his own studio at home so he doesn't have to pay studio time. Because as the listeners know, most of the advances that artists get go towards the recording of their albums.
Right, they don't get to keep that.
and the MCA album didn't come out, and it didn't come out for three main reasons. The first is that J. Dilla decided, if I'm going to be an artist, I'm going to focus on my own lyricism, and I'm going to get producers that I love to make the beats. So they signed J. Dilla to make this incredible J. Dilla album, and there's no J. Dilla beats on it, right?
Right.
That was
right.
The first thing. And it's not so much that the beats weren't great. They were. He has great taste. The problem is he was paying all of these producers out of that budget, right? So he's quickly going to hit that budget limit. The second thing is that Wendy Goldstein got a better job. And so his, as we say, his rabbi left the building. And also JD, the third reason is that JD was unmanageable. He didn't really have a professional manager. You know, people like Q-Tip and Busta Rhymes were managed by Chris Lighty, who was, definitely of and from hip hop, but a business person who could get things done. Common. One of the things I love about this book is we get to meet Derek Dudley, Common's manager. Where would Common be without Derek, right? And Derek, it was his idea for JD to do this whole deal, right? And Derek found that he just couldn't manage him. There's a point where Derek has the idea, you know, JD should be producing for Justin Timberlake and NSYNC. And James is like, I don't want to do that crap, right? And so Derek Douglas like, listen, if all he wants for me to do is babysit him working with Common and I'm not making any new connections for him, what's the use? So it's...
Well, he was never going to color within the lines, Dan.
Yep.
When that period is so productive in Philadelphia is happening and Erykah Badu is working and Common is working and the Roots are working and there's three different labels involved. And yes. The label has no idea that this guy, Dilla, has just crafted a track and it's for Common, but D'Angelo steals it.
Yes.
And then, you know, D'Angelo makes good to Common by giving him a different beat, right? Works out good for everybody. But that's not how the lawyers at the major labels play it, is it?
No. No, it's not.
They're going to read your book and say, holy cow, you know, our dime was paying for some other artist to have great music.
That's why we never saw that album didn't, you know, see the light of day, because essentially there are things beyond his control. The macroeconomics of the record business. He had a group called Slum Village, and they did this incredible album in 1998 for A&M Records that really is, I think, one of the most important creative documents of his career and certainly of hip-hop too, because it is the debut of this new machine time field. And A&M basically folded during the merger between PolyGram and Universal. Then he signs to MCA and MCA closes. And that's the fourth reason.
Well, it's interesting. That was an incredible time for the music industry and hip-hop, because the Soul Aquarian group that was meeting at Electric Lady on the regular for a few years there, it just seemed to be like a one ongoing session that produced all these amazing records.
Yeah.
And here's this kid from Detroit right in the middle of it. They bring him in as Questlove is saying, we got to bring God in to the sessions. You describe very well 2000, watershed year for that movement, as well as J. Dilla being at the center of two key records, the Like Water for Chocolate record by Common and Voodoo by D'Angelo.
Yes.
And it's the breakthrough record for Common commercially. It's also an artistic success. A song that he didn't even want, The Light, becomes his biggest hit. He's key to the aesthetic of Voodoo. And then I'm heartbroken reading him being heartbroken about not being feeling like he was even credited for
D'Angelo
that record.
Doesn't credit him.
Yeah.
What happened there?
It's funny. I had a 2-hour conversation with D'Angelo, and I didn't ask him about the credit. That was the one thing I didn't ask him about. And I don't know, maybe there was a part of me as a reporter that knew that I would probably break his heart knowing that he broke, you know, Dilla's heart like that. And when I say heartbroken, it wasn't devastating. They were friends thereafter. And I think the reality of that is that D'Angelo just didn't finish. I think if D'Angelo knew then what he knows now, that James wouldn't be around for a while, I think one of those songs would have been on it. And actually, my wish is that D'Angelo finishes what he started. I would love to hear on the next D'Angelo album him rocking over that beat that JD gave him. I think that would be an amazing song. That's my hope.
And I mean, I think the way you describe it, though, too, is J. Dilla's amazing contribution to music, maybe totally subconsciously, was that he put programming on the same level as musicianship. And his programming influenced the way those musicians treated those beats on the entire record. So even if he didn't directly write a song or produce a song, his feel and his aesthetic was essential to the way that record was made. So somehow there must have been a way to acknowledge that somehow.
That cross-pollination,
we didn't have the vocabulary for describing what that job was, right, at the time. And maybe we still don't.
I think it was an oversight. But, you know, it's interesting that the reissue of Voodoo, for which the chair of the Clive Davis Institute, where I work, Jason King, he wrote the liner notes. J. Dilla is at the center of those liner notes. The essay is called Time is Out of Joint. I love that.
Let's blame the record company. You know, some record company lawyer is looking and saying, why was J. Dilla on this credit? He didn't contribute to any song. He's going to sue us and want to get paid.
Right.
That's what Clive Davis taught me Professor Charnas, is always blame the record industry.
Blame the record industry.
All right, yeah. A complete guilty pleasure question. Electric Circus follows up, you know, like Water for Chocolate. I think it's an amazing record. I've been waiting for the rest of the world to discover that record ever since. Common told me when it came out, you can't in Chicago escape this radio station at the time that was huge called The Loop, right? Classic rock. They had Loop Girls at all these events and all that. You know, but Common discovers Pink Floyd. Holy cow. I mean, it's up there to me with De La Soul and Paul's Boutique as the great psychedelic hip-hop records. And Dilla had a lot to do with that one, too. But even in your book, Electric Circus doesn't get the love I think it deserves. But this is just me. This is just me.
You're right. I think a part of it is the worry about sprawl. And the other part of it is the kind of reporting it would have taken to figure all of that out. I think there it is. I mean, you know, an oral history of Electric Circus, I think, would be incredible.
People say I got soul. Look at all the records I hold. The lives I affect and connect and control. With me in your basement, your mama got blow. I provide the vibe to keep the strippers on pose.
For a younger journalist than you, me, or Greg, to do a 33 to 30.
The whole.
But, you know, in Electric Circus's defense, right, I think that what Common was, I think at some point in the around that time in the book, I say the success of black artists in that time period should, by rights, give them all the creative license that, say, white rock artists would have. The chance to experiment, the chance to do other things that we expect from a band like Pink Floyd, but don't necessarily expect for, you know, acts like Common and the Roots. We live and work in an industry that relies on black talent and black genius, but doesn't give that talent and genius the same leeway and runway economically and creatively. There's much to love in Electric Circus, even if it isn't in the vein of Common and JD that most people know.
You know, the history of music could be essentially built on the idea that mistakes created the next innovation. And this is the innovation that keeps on giving, because you talk about Dilla, even after his death, continuing to exert an influence over the way or the direction of hip hop or club music. Yeah. The flip side of that, not the flip side, but corollary to that, is that somebody has to hear what this guy is doing and understand that that mistake is cool. And I want to be part of it too. I arrived at a completely fresh understanding of Q-Tip as just a really smart guy who got it early on. Like, this is, we need to take this and run with it, and being very unselfish about it. But the whole idea of a mistake, what is it in Jay Dilla's personality? What was it about him as a human being that sort of led him to, like, identify that is what I want to build my musical career around?
It's such a good question, and I think it goes back to what Jim was talking about with stuttering. Very early on, when he's still, I believe, just in high school, he meets the people who he'll be in Slum Village with. He meets them for the first time in this sort of rap battle. And his verse, his battle verse, is stuttered intentionally. So what he did was he turned what other people would see as error or wrongness or weakness into a strength. T3 said he fell out. He said, "I never heard anybody rhyme like that before. It was amazing." So that could be one of the genesis of that embrace of error. And so what he would do in later years is he would literally slow down samples to a crawl. You know, when you play a record slowly, like if it's 45 RPM and you play it at 33, all the mistakes on that record, the minute little errors that you don't notice, will elongate. And he did that in song after song after song, slowing down that source material to reveal error. He loved it.
It shows the humanity in the machine. You know, that's part of the thing. You know, Dilla has a respect for Kanye and an anger at himself for respecting Kanye. Something like that. I'm paraphrasing what you said. Because in my mind, you know, the next big production leap in hip-hop, one of them came from what Kanye West was doing early on. So Dilla yields to Kanye. Where do you think Dilla would have gone? Because I think one of the reasons Kanye annoyed him is he saw that Kanye was doing something, right? Where would he have gone? Where could he have taken the idea of Dilla time and his aesthetic?
Well, he did have plans. He had plans to do an album with Q-Tip, to form a little duo called Buddy Lee, which could have been really amazing. He was already influenced by Kanye, freely influenced by Kanye and Madlib, to really look at sampled source material as everything is fair game. Vocals, instrumentation, sound effects, everything is going to be put into the musical blender. I also think he might have gone more into jazz. As jazz artists embraced him, he might have done more of that stuff that he did with Blue Note back in 2003, 2004. One thing I am pretty sure of is that he would have kept evolving, because he had that same temperament to just reinvent himself and to do things he hadn't done before. And I think part of the impetus of that was that everybody was copying him. He had to outrun his competitors.
Okay, so we've had this really fascinating discussion of this artist who I think probably a lot of people only know very little about. For the neophyte, where do you start with J. Dilla to sort of appreciate what he did for music?
Well, a really great place to start is where he started, his very first release, which is a song called Runnin' by the Far Side, which has this sort of tumbling rhythmic feel, an incredible, auspicious debut. Other than that, I guess one of the things I'm really trying to do in this book is to pull people away from what has become the entrance point for learning about Dilla, which is Donuts, which is the last album, the one he did as he was, you know, ill and dying, and to really pull people back to, I would say, three albums, right? Fantastic Volume 2 by Slum Village, which is his group and the debut of this time feel. Like Water for Chocolate by Common, which is, again, how he worked with other folks in the Soulquarians. And then Voodoo, which is the first time that his time feel is taken out for a walk exclusively by traditional musicians. So I'd say those are the three.
You know, not to end on a down note, but in the years since his death, Acrimony, fights over his legacy. We've seen this a million times in the history of popular music, and it's a tragedy every time.
It's very common, as you say, pardon the pun, but he was in arrears on his taxes for every year of his career, from 95 until he died in 2006. And so while he had a trove of music and also his royalties to hand off to his heirs, his four heirs, who are his mother, brother, and two daughters, there was this huge tax bill that needed to be paid off before anything could be disbursed. And it took over a decade, something like 15 years to pay that down. I think that the estate of James DeWitt Yancey was finally able to start paying the heirs in 2017. And in the meantime, it's very understandable that people say, well, what about his mom, right? Who took care of him, who supported his career, who was essentially his virtual assistant, and that the fact that money was going to his mother caused some friction with the professionals who ran the estate. What I try to do in the book is really have and show empathy for folks on both sides of that particular argument. It's messy. It's conflict. But again, that's J. Dilla.
Is that one of the things, Dan? So as an associate professor at NYU, my alma mater, you know, now that the music industry is being reinvented, I hope there's a good dozen classes that are teaching people how to take care of the business. Something Dilla never did.
Yeah, well, we really do try. Even though J. Dilla didn't love the P's and Q's part of the business, I do want to say that his mother and the professionals around him really, really did try to help him.
But like you said, you know, I mean, one of the reasons Common's had such a long and fruitful career is he's had Derek Dudley, you know. I mean, he's had the guy, the right brain to the left brain, creative.
One of the things I hope comes from this book is that people understand how sampled music is an art form, and that one of the realizations I had while writing this book is that all of this wonderful art that he did, and none of it has the protection of law. If you and Greg write a song, you've performed it, and I want to remake it, I can do that as long as I pay you, you know, a few pennies per song, you know, for the song you wrote. There's no protection. Mm-hmm. There's no convention like that for using bits and pieces of other people's records. And we actually have the technological ability to do that now. And instead, what happens is you have lawsuits, you have people not being creative because they're afraid of lawsuits. And that's anathema to what copyright law is really, the other part of copyright law, which is supposed to be.
The three of us have been journalists. We have been writing about the ridiculous nature of copyright law. And still nothing gets rewritten. Nothing gets changed. You have, you know, the Disneys of the world wanting forever to perpetuate copyright protections. And art is suffering.
Mm-hmm. We have been talking to Dan Charnas, author of a terrific book, Dilla Time. Dan, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, and thank you both for your work.
That's it for our talk with Dan Charnas. Now we want to hear what you think. Can you think of other examples of unique rhythms beyond Dilla Time that have had that much of an influence? Leave a message on our website so we can play it on the show. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we pay tribute to some amazing records that are flying underneath the mainstream radar. We call it Buried Treasures. It's time for a new round of those.
First of 2022.
Yes, and on our next bonus podcast, I'll pay tribute to the late Betty Davis, so you won't want to miss that.
Sounds good, Greg. For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our intern, Mary Berthold. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.